This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
We're turning to another phase in Bob's life and career, and I'm very pleased to introduce as the facilitator of that session, or this session, Jenny Isaacs, who was Bob's predecessor at the Australia Council. She's an author, a curator, a consultant, a speaker, and a specialist in Indigenous art. And that forms the substance of what we're about to discuss this afternoon and in this session, which goes till 2:45. So, ladies and gentlemen, no more ado, Jenny Isaacs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, all the welcomes have been done and the marvellous background that you've heard about this morning that covers Bob's stellar national and international career. But there is a period of time of about 7 or 8 years when Bob seemingly diverted out of the museum world into an entirely new world, not just for him, I guess, but for most white Australians at the time. And that was to remote Aboriginal Australia. Now, we know his stellar career up to that point as a museum person, but suddenly he became, just as described this morning by Neil, I think he had a wonderful description of him as elegantly and deftly moving like a politician through the museums of the world. Bob took on that role and capacity in Aboriginal Australia in the early 70s. Now, I'd been in this role for sort of 3 years before Bob came into the picture, and I knew him well. I used to go to Adelaide a lot, and he came to Sydney. And so we were, in a sense, crafting and masterminding the future. And really, it was Bob's mind at work. I was a child in Bob's awe, because I was only about 23 at the time. Nick mentioned that I think it was in his dates about 67 before tribal people and urban people met, where tribal people might have. And I say tribal, I'm going to use old-fashioned terms that are politically incorrect to date, but it'll maybe put your head into the picture that I've had to return to in my mind to do this today. In 1963, to give you a picture, Tiwi dancers and dancers from Arnhem Land came down to Melbourne to Her Majesty's Theatre, organised by the Elizabethan Theatre Trust. And the program and the press that I've recently read about that performance tells you what Australia thought of Aboriginal people at the time, that there were going to be throbbing drums, the primitive savages from remote parts of Australia were going to, your hairs would rise on your arm when you saw these savages appearing at Her Majesty's Theatre in Melbourne. And there, in amongst them, were some of the stellar leaders of the Aboriginal communities who eventually became part of the Aboriginal Arts Board and the movement that resulted. People like Declan Apuatimi, who became a world-famous bark painter, taken up by Lord Alastair McAlpine and so on. And Eddie Purantata Mary, as a young boy, dancing an imp dance on the stage of Melbourne, became a pioneer in the field of ceramics and the first Indigenous potter to start his own studio that still continues on Bathurst Island today. And it gives you a sort of sense of lived history of also another phrase Neil was talking about. Bob's incredible capacity was to link and see beyond the material culture, to see that people are part of material culture, and the way you get minds and people moved to change their attitudes and conservatism of the past was to give them a big picture of the possibilities for mankind, not just Australian culture, but mankind itself. And that goes right, links together with the rock art history, the history from Altamira to Africa to Australia that Bob was on a hunt for, to find the missing connections, to prove the antiquity of Australia and its connection, and how he, in fact, pushed back those dates and made the world sit up and take notice. When it came to the Aboriginal world, his masterful political tactics and his love of people, his tremendous warmth and simplicity and generosity of spirit was felt by Aboriginal people. I once asked Wanjuk Marika, this is Carol's cue to hold up the book, how he knew that Bob would become his friend and brother and do his will when he became the chair of the Aboriginal Arts Board. And he said, oh, we know, we look into the eyes. We can tell he is the one, he's the chosen one to do what we want him to do. Just before today, John Moriarty, in the session we had at lunch just chatting about what we'd say, was saying that that 7 years was so fundamentally important in Australian culture as it exists today, because traditional people and urban people came together in what I can only call a conflagration. It had not happened. How could that not have happened in 200 years? But in Arnhem Land, people called urban Aboriginals yellow fellas. Wanjuk himself used to say to me, they've lost their culture, they don't know nothing. And this took a lot of negotiation, coming together, warm friendships, and these often happened in and around the Aboriginal Arts Board meetings. And so I come to how Bob and I began to work together when he took over the directorship of the Aboriginal Arts Board after a massive seminar where we invited 800 people to Canberra to, as Carol describes it, basically thrash out a, what was the word you used? A charter for how the government and the Aboriginal people themselves, they were all exclusively Aboriginal, the committees that reported to the Aboriginal boards, would design the way government could support the future of Aboriginal culture and art. Supporting traditional art on the one hand, giving tribal communities the scope to build museums, to develop their visual arts, to move into public performances of ceremonial arts, such as Nick was describing in terms of what were called corroborees. But perhaps more importantly, to build on the genesis of urban programs, which had certainly happened in the time I was there, with things like Black Theatre, NASDA, which Carol will talk about in a little while, and develop, even more importantly perhaps, literature and writing programs so there would be an Indigenous voice for the future of this country. And you only have to look in any library, in any museum in the country to see how successful that was. And that, I would have to say, we've all agreed here, thrashing it out, and all the people I rang to try and get them to come, we do agree that it simply would not have happened without the mastermind of Bob at work behind the scenes. Today I'm delighted to have with us someone who regards himself as a ring-in, because he was due to drive Mary Duro, the elder from the South Coast, but she got ill this morning. And that's Chris Fondham, who was the first secretary of the Aboriginal Arts Board. So he's a wealth of information for any of you who want to know the detail. And above him is the first Aboriginal Arts Board. At one of their typical meetings, someone said, oh, you know, they had to move to a formal situation. Forget it. The Aboriginal Arts Board operated in very unusual ways, and perhaps I'll ask Chris then to take up on that.
First, let me give Mary's apology, but she's so much wanting to come. I rang her last night, and I think it was partly anxiety, but she was having chest pains, and she's getting on a little bit, and decided she wouldn't make the journey. But I've undertaken to report back, and perhaps even take a photograph of you if that's possible later on. That's right. I mean, someone did mention all the meetings we had in Sydney. I can't remember too many meetings in Sydney. Bob, you know, probably pioneered community cabinet meetings, I'd say. I mean, part of the whole sort of philosophy of the thing was to get out, particularly in the early days, and to meet the folk and make Aboriginal Australia feel the board was sort of part of their lives. It was partly soliciting applications and just generally enthusing the community. Often as not, really. It wouldn't just be a board meeting in a remote place or a place where there was significant Aboriginal communities. There'd be concerts put on just to complicate it a little bit further. But we've and they were great. A lot of the board members were artists themselves, and there was always many performing artists and so forth in the local communities we went to, and so it was quite a celebration. This is a photo. The photographer is Bob Edwards, and most of those are founding board members plus. So if I can just perhaps run across the top from left to right and identify them. Chicka Dixon is with his hand on his chin. Ruby Hammond from Adelaide. Above Ruby is one of our other project officers. I'm not sure at that stage whether he was. He might have been working at DAA, I think, Chris McGuigan. Next to Ruby is not a board member, a blow-in from Cairns, Clary Grogan, who was just part there. Underneath Clary with the camera to his eye is Eddie Marber, who wasn't a founding member, but at this stage was might have been his first meeting, I'd say. Next row, Vi Stanton from Darwin, Wanjuk Narika from Yirrkala, a young man, I think, possibly from Arakoon. Eric Kawoila is not in the photo, but he was certainly at the meeting, because we stayed at, this is at Laura. We're all sitting under the Big Horse Gallery, and we've just forded the creek and looked at some wonderful sort of cave galleries. Our erstwhile leader in this adventure was Dick Ruffsey, who I'll come to in a moment. So going across there, we've got a young man from Arakoon, I think, Muckwood Mackay, who was General Manager of the Aboriginal Arts and Crafts Proprietary Limited at that stage. Next to Muckwood is Raphael Apiotimi, I think brother of Declan, I'm pretty sure. Next to Raphael is Tim Lura Jabaljari, and then with the stick across here is Percy Tresides, whose pub we were staying at down on the river flat. Coming back across again to Terry Widders, a founding member. Kate Carney, our exhibition officer, who wanted to be here today, and Jenny has a statement from Kate to read. Me in my younger days next to Kate. Coming down a little bit further, Dick Ruffsey sticking his head out behind Harold Blair, a famous Aboriginal tenor. Lying back in typical fashion is Mick Miller, and finally we have Ken Colbung. There's a couple of people who were at that meeting who aren't in the photograph. I've mentioned Eric Kawoila. I don't know why he's not there. Albert Barunga was there, but he was possibly a little sort of old to be fording creeks and so forth. Mrs. Kitty Dick, our member from Weeper South, was also at that meeting. So there they are. And what a wonderful group of people they were. And they, together with Bob, sort of forged this wonderful enterprise called the Aboriginal Arts Board and the programs that it set in place, which continue to today. I particularly remember Eric Kawoila being there, because the moment we arrived in a bus from Cooktown or somewhere, and we're sort of looking around for somewhere to stay at this pub, there was a few of us sort of eyeing the front veranda. It was fairly warm, and I know a big black snake sort of came crawling out from under the veranda, and Eric, quick as a wink, just pulled off this very heavy leather belt he had and cracked it on the snake. And that was the end of the snake, but there was a few of us sort of decided we might actually sleep inside the pub that night.
Okay. My reading of that image is thinking of Bob taking it. You've got to think of the Bob that many of you know who don't know that Bob, that when he mixed out in the bush, he was like the Bob you saw with his Land Rover. Generous and urbane and totally relaxed in remote Aboriginal Australia. However, Bob was always, as today, impeccably dressed in a blue suit. In the bush, a safari suit or some such equivalent in the Dunstan era. When those of you who may be students go to the resources of this wonderful museum where Bob has given his magnificent collection of papers and books and so on, and you go to the papers and records of the Aboriginal Arts Board, which he's deposited, you keep this image in mind and look at the minutes of board meetings and have a quiet smile at the diplomacy, magnificent carriage of the wishes and aims and expectations of people from all over Australia meeting and killing snakes and wanting a future for their very depressed and miserable families, and a way to make a life in the future. And then read the minutes and realise that these minutes were what the government was reading in order to decide how much the Aboriginal Arts Board would have the following year. And you will applaud Bob Edwards even more. So there was that side of the Aboriginal Arts Board. I wasn't going to tell any anecdotes because this was going to be recorded, and I thought, oh, there's none that are really for the public record. They're all so hair-raising. And then good old Dick Kimber said, go for it, mate. So there's one, because I know if they were alive and here with me today, they'd acknowledge it and say, yeah, that was like it was. And that was Bob's skill at getting everybody to turn up for the meetings. And this is where I came into the picture, because although I'd left, I then had young children and I lived in a sort of ramshackle house with a few other people. And this is another phrase. I've been choosing your phrases and linking them. You've missed it, but this is one I've got still up my sleeve. You referred to Bob finding a home and comfort and inspiration with the Mallets in London, and you called it high bohemia. Well, in the early 70s, my house was what you might have called an artistic collective. We all had hair to our waists, and Carol lived there, Van Coopy lived there, famous photographer John Rhodes lived there. You know, it was a scene, and from that place, partly some of the programs from the Aboriginal Arts predecessor board were hatched for the Tent Embassy in Canberra. Things like urban theatre program, $2,000. What did that pay for? Buses that carted everyone who turned up at the Aboriginal Medical Service that week down to Canberra and Carol to lead the dancers that she was training to perform the fantastic beginnings of what is now Bangarra Theatre. You'll hear a lot more about that in a minute. But anyway, this was a heaven sent to Bob, because a taxi would arrive each day, I mean, the day before the Aboriginal Arts Board meeting, and in both Dick Ruffsey's era and in Wanjuk's era, there were usually one or two people who needed a mattress for the night, who might not, put it this way, who might not have made the 9 o'clock start, as many of us didn't this morning, I'm sure. And so friendships were forged, and families, family relations that still exist right throughout Australia were formed because of deep friendships over that time, and Bob's remarkable linking of people. At this point, I'm going to turn to Bob's acumen in the visual arts, which, of course, is the world he's remained in to the present, by reading something Kate Kahn has contributed as to honour Bob. Kate was Bob's right-hand person in the Aboriginal Arts Board running the exhibitions program, particularly international exhibitions. And she wants specifically to talk about Papunya paintings. In the time I was there, Jeff Barden, who started the whole movement off, had ended up really with a back room full of boards he couldn't sell. Nobody in Australia was the slightest bit interested, because they weren't made with ochre and they didn't look primitive. It was a time in primitive art of the world where Aboriginal art as such was not exhibited in a single Australian art gallery, let alone international. And when the famous books on art around the world would have a very minor two pages at the back of Oceania where they would mention that Aboriginal people had no portable art to speak of and therefore did not make art. So it was very hard to know how to support Jeff Barden because of the reluctance of Australia to be the slightest bit interested in these little gems. And Kate says, when you see the success of Western desert art today on the world scene, it's hard to believe it almost did not survive. and she thinks its status and standing rests on Bob's deep respect for the people combined with his canny marketing skills and foresight. The early 1970s were desperate times for Papunya art. There were paintings everywhere and no market. Artists were selling their paintings in the Alice Springs pubs for $20, a far cry from today's prices. The board became the sole buyer of the paintings, and as Bob has said, we had paintings stacked everywhere, walls, floors coming out of our ears. Nobody wanted them. What were we going to do? It's ironic that today these early paintings attract the highest prices at auction and are eagerly sought by collectors. In fact, as we know, export permits are now required before permission is even given to send these early paintings overseas. Bob thought the best way to attack the problem was to promote the art in overseas exhibitions. In that way, a new market would open and the domestic art market might also pick up. In Australia, the so-called Dotty paintings were not generally accepted and not regarded as real Aboriginal art. And the other problem was the differing values placed on painting itself by the artists and their market. The elders placed a high value on the subject of a painting, for example, the painting of a special area of ritual significance, and they regarded that as more important than any artistic merit placed on something else by a potential purchaser. Peter Fannin, who was the person who followed Jeff Barden at Papunya to help with the art, in a letter to the Aboriginal Arts Board, drew attention to a painting of an important yellow ochre site. And the colour of the painting, predominantly yellow, was not bought or of interest to any dealer. Yet it was extremely highly valued by the artist, who demanded a very high price for it. And that sort of scenario happened right across the board in Australia at the time and would cover bark paintings as well. So, briefly, the board initiated a program of commissioning paintings for overseas exhibitions, and it would appear in the minutes as a grant to such and such a community to develop a program in painting or whatever. But in fact, it was the board managed to amass enough paintings to send overseas and then leave them there in museums and other institutions to stimulate interest in a totally unknown world, which was the Aboriginal world of Australia. The company Papunya Tula Artists was formed at that time, and the artists were the shareholders. Now, that must have been an original and very revolutionary act, potential to put governments offside, but masterfully handled by Bob. The industry was suddenly on a business footing, something it had previously lacked. We have to say it didn't solve all the problems, and for years the board covered the debts of the company. But out of these desperate times came the success that is Western desert art today, thanks to the Aboriginal Arts Board and Bob's deep respect for the people and their culture, combined with his passion, vision and drive for the enterprise to succeed. So I think that reinforces what Neil said earlier. I might just add one more little anecdote that Kate said, because it's a beauty. She would often go to the openings of these international exhibitions, and at the time I was curating and helping her with that. And there was one in particular she recalls that opened in Japan, and it was a bit of a coup. It was in a major gallery in Kyoto. Quote, "Everything was fine and the paintings were hung, and then I returned to the gallery a little time before the exhibition was officially opened and was amused to find that the Japanese curators had placed small stuffed koalas over the top of each painting." They were emphasising the connection with Australia of these alien objects, without quite realising, of course, the intimate connection that the paintings had with Australia itself. So I like that one. Well, I've mentioned the tent embassy and the dancing that took place there. Urban Aboriginal art got a huge shot in the arm with the appearance in Australia of the Eliopa Mare dance group from Harlem. And Carol Johnson's name was across the billboard as the principal dancer. Carol stayed on in Australia and went through very troubled times. She's the most persevering person I've ever met in my life, operating on minuscule grants from one moment to the next until the arrival of Bob Edwards and his concept that he developed to her of how to create a genuine Indigenous college that would create a new art form for Australia. And without wanting to pinch her lines, I know that its culmination really we've seen in at least the last two or three Olympic Games. Carol.
Thank you. Yes, I came in 1972, and that was the year that the Tent Embassy was established. And I can remember seeing on television the images and people talking about the Aboriginal Tent Embassy. Now, the dance company that I came with, Elio Pomari, was very involved in social comment. In fact, we believed that dance or the arts could help challenge people's thinking. If it was entertaining and if it really touched the emotions, it would challenge people's thinking. So I came from that kind of background. And we knew that there were Aboriginal people and there were black people like ourselves in Australia. And we knew a little bit about the background. So Elio actually created a ballet about the land rights situation. He didn't use Aboriginal and Australian. He used the Native American and the colonists. We also had anti-war pieces, and we had pieces that evolved the history of African American from Africa to the present day riots. So all of these works, as well as we had beautiful handle works and works and works about religion and things like that, and work based on a Garcia Lorca story. So dance had to be challenging and interesting, but we knew we wanted to meet up with Aboriginal people, and we made sure we did. And we did an unofficial workshop with a group of people in Adelaide, and from there we made tickets available, and then Jenny made tickets available for people in Sydney. And from what they tell me, the dance spoke very much to the Aboriginal people, because they felt that it was about them almost. Many of the works was about their total situation. I knew I wasn't going to stay with the company, because I happened to believe when I came here that Australia was close to Asia, and I wanted to do a Southeast Asian tour. And then I found out it wasn't. But I had organized through our State Department the possibility of this tour. But I thought, well, I'll stay in Australia, because I became very interested, became friendly with meeting Jenny and Jenny's kitchen. In Jenny's kitchen, so much happened in Jenny's kitchen in terms of meeting all of the various Aboriginal people and artists that were really trying to accomplish something and do something. I mean, some of them, they might have been called activists, but they wanted a change for the people. And the thing that I remember, one of the things that I remember coming to Australia in that first year is the Aboriginal people themselves just thought how downtrodden they were and how bad situations were. Now, I went to some people's homes, like the Bostocks, and I think I was at Ruby Hammond's home in Adelaide. And these were people who had very well-kept homes, and they were trying to do something in the community. But these very people would say, well, but it's really bad. And they would take me around, and they'd want to show the worst. They just say, this is how bad it is. This is how bad it is. If people are sick, they're not eating. And they'd show you the abject poverty, even though most of the people that I knew were people who were striving to make major changes in their culture. And people were very much afraid also to do something, so that these people like Popolco and Gary Foley, the Bostocks, Ruby Hammond, John Mariotti, all of these people were there wanting to make a change. And I became very much involved with this because I felt that maybe I could help with my dance. And I was allowed to develop an urban dance workshop. Now, people think, well, what does that have to do with Aboriginal? Well, it wasn't about the movements per se, because as Elia said, the movements aren't the dance. It's what you're dancing about. It's how you put it together. It's what you're saying. And it's the stories that you're going to tell through the movement. So that the urban Aboriginal people were telling the stories of their situation. And we were able to perform this at the 10 Embassy. We started developing a dance that actually told the story of what was happening. One of the dances I used, and I used American music at the time and then changed it to Aboriginal music later, but, oh, there's grieving in the plum grove. There's been another lynching. And people were feeling that happened there. So by dancing the stories of what was happening actually at the 10 Embassy that was put down, that eventually was pulled down by the police, Aboriginal people had come from Adelaide as far as Cairns and got together, and for the first time they saw urban Aboriginal people doing dance that was meaningful. They knew they had the traditional dance, but that wasn't something that many urban people felt they had, could do, or knew how to do, or could be permitted to do. But this dance, where they were telling their own stories through their own movements and movements that they might come in contact with in a disco, this could be theirs, and this they wanted to develop. And this is what we worked on, and I felt, well, maybe I can help in this area. So that's what I did. We started, and that is the genesis of what later became the NASDA. It was a school that maybe we could develop into a company. I went away after 6 months and came back, and by that time the seminar had happened and the Aboriginal Arts Board was established. Now, I feel like I had went to that seminar because through the stories more of Brian Siren, but by that time Bob Edwards was part of the was the director of the Aboriginal Arts Board, and I had that charter and declaration with what they were going to do in the area of the traditional arts and what they were doing in urban arts, and I felt, well, okay, I was trying to follow as much as possible the dream of encouraging the arts and bringing art development and dance development into the urban community. One of the things that I can remember Steve Mam saying when he saw us dancing is that now that the urban people are dancing and telling their stories, we've got all of the dance covered. We have the traditional dance of Aboriginal people from the tribal areas. I'll use the word, and also, only 2 minutes. It's such a fantastic story. Anyway, I should say that the dance was totally covered by the time we had the urban people, the tribal people, and the Torres Strait Island people. And this is what we tried to put into the dance. Now, without Bob, we were struggling all the time, and we had to put in this grant and then another grant, and I would talk things over eventually with Bob about some different types of programs and things, and we inched our way so that we got first a 3-month grant, and then we'd get 6 months, and then we'd get a little bit to do this project, and then we'd get a year grant, and it developed. I think it developed because he saw the success of what was happening in terms of urban dance. I don't know that he loved urban dance or even thought it was that important, but he knew it was important to the people, and he could see that what we were doing might have a future, which it has had and certainly stimulated. But one of the things that probably without his help, we might not have become the institute that we have become is he introduced us to the Sydney College of the Arts, and he thought, well, if you're going to establish an institute, we need it. And the Arts Board really couldn't support a school, and this is what we were at the time, and we had to be. He provided that link and was very supportive in making sure that we could we developed in that area, as well as in the arts area, where we were given funding to do arts programs and dance programs, but for the training, which is what had to happen before we could become the dance company that is Bengara, so that we developed from nothing into a little urban workshop, into the workshops that were funded totally by the board, to the Institute NASDA, and then into Bengara, the dance company. And that took about 13 years. And what I like to think is that without, and if people can realize, without the early work and all of that work, what you saw and what the whole world saw at the Olympics in terms of the big Aboriginal performance in 2000 couldn't have happened without NASDA and all that work, because every leader of each group, be it traditional, be it Torres Strait Island, or be it the urban groups, so the leaders had some relationship. The tribal people, of course, had been teachers to the urban students, and many of the urban leaders had been students at the dance. And so I have to thank Bob and all of the work that you have to thank that was done for what is here today.
Thanks, Carol. I really twisted Carol's arm to come because I knew how spectacular the success of that story was, and how incredibly pivotal was Bob's strategic reorganisation of the structure of the beginnings of Aboriginal performance in this country. And in the same sense as you've heard about museums, he created, behind the scenes, knowing already that it could exist, that national identity for Australia that the world has come to accept, that's always been there. You know, they think that's Australia's national dance group now. And now I'd like to turn to a dear old friend from way back in Adelaide years when I first met Bob, and that's John Moriarty. I might run through, I mean, John is a stellar Indigenous leader of today, and was even then. His numerous positions would fill two pages. He's chairman and co-founder of Jumbana and of John Moriarty and Associates. He went to Flinders University, he had a Churchill Fellowship, an honorary doctor of the University of South Australia, and a board member of numerous organisations, more recently the Sydney Harbour Federation Trust, the National Indigenous Council, the National Aboriginal and Islander Health Council, and South Australian Museum, amongst many others. And I'm very delighted to introduce him today to talk about what Bob's life and person has meant to him.
Thank you, Jenny. What can you say in a few minutes for a bloke like this? Fantastic. I first met Bob way back, I think, in the late 60s. And I was involved in all the politics of national politics and Aboriginal affairs, coming to Canberra in my little Volkswagen over Easter, you know, paying while I was going to university, trying to pay for my fares over. I reckon we did that trip about eight times, on and off, fighting for the 67 referendum, which we were successful in bringing about. But during this time in Adelaide, I suppose we had a great deal of leadership there. And I kept touching Bob with his work and my work just continually for all these years. And when I think back to the museum days, I thought the map that Norman Tyndale did, and Bob took over the position in the South Australian Museum of Tyndale's position and the work that he did in those early years to define the tribal areas throughout the country when it was not a political issue. And I think that was a great step for Aboriginal people in those days. Bob took on that role because he kept it, that same integrity at the museum, but he wanted to get in to all these levels on the cultural aspect, but he never forgot about the people. He was one of those that was very instrumental with in his quiet way to weave the politics into it in such a at a low level that he achieved without all the you know, the hassles that we did on the front of chasing governments to make these particular changes. I was happy to meet Bob in those days, and I became a member of the South Australian Museum Board. And I was grateful for that because it gave me an insight into what that museum really had for us. It has, still has, as Philip mentioned this morning, the greatest collection of Aboriginal art, artefacts and memorabilia that goes back many, many years, and it's the best in the world. And I think we have a real strong culture there that Bob helped to not only partially develop, but also to bring it up to those other different levels. But I'd like to just swing away from that for a moment, because I think it's important that the Aboriginal aspects on the political side be swung right away from where there's been accolades given to certain peoples for certain things, but it should come back, I think, in a proper way. For instance, if you look at the Aboriginal flag, I'll go back to NAIDOC, National Aboriginal Day Observance Committee. That committee was run by mainly the Methodist Church and other church people too, until I became chairman way back in the 60s. And Bob was a very strong supporter of that in his own way, linking in the cultural aspects with exhibitions or pushing Aboriginal art and other things that were important on the cultural side. During NAIDOC, we were still fighting for, you know, as Carol mentioned, the tent embassy was going on here, but there are some of us that were right to the forefront on the political level with Gough Whitlam, and even with old Gordon, I've forgotten his name, Bob Hawke took Gordon Bryant. He's a member for Wills. Bob Hawke took his position, but Gordon Bryant was one of those fellows that fought long and hard with Aboriginal people right at the grassroots. He travelled a lot. He was our first Federal Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, and I thought he did a great job, but then he was removed and because he was too close to Aboriginal people. But from that movement stemmed many things. The Aboriginal Arts Board was established, and Bob was the first director, although he held the position for quite some time before he took over as a person that's officially nominated or given that position. But during this time too, the Aboriginal flag was being developed. And I was in a home in Adelaide with a fellow called Harold Thomas, who's from Alice Springs. And Harold was an artist. He was a budding artist. And he was adopted by a family, Reverend Wallace. And they lived at St. John's Church Rectory in the city of Adelaide. And I asked Harold, because I was the one of these fellows with Malcolm Cooper and Gordon Briscoe and Vince Copley and Jerry Hill, to be a member of the Aborigines Progress Association, an Aboriginal association that was much spurned in those days because we were fighting for Aboriginal equality, and that wasn't the done thing in those days. We even demonstrated outside of Parliament House on North Terrace, and we were asking for land rights during the Dunstan era, and we were frowned upon by even some of the city Aboriginal people there, even though some of those Aboriginal people that were demonstrating fought in the Second World War, and they were not allowed back on their reserves because they had fought in the war, and they were not allowed back because they had an exemption, and they couldn't even go back for funerals or even see their families. And we had those sort of people fighting for Aboriginal rights, demonstrating with us. Back then, Harold Thomas was asked by myself and Malcolm Cooper, but I kept pestering Harold because I knew Reverend Wallace, and I used to go around to their place quite often and used to try and get Harold to design the Aboriginal flag. But he eventually did. But that was done at the South Australian Museum. Don't tell the museum staff that, but Bob Edwards was instrumental in having Harold sit there at that desk and paint that Aboriginal flag. And he consulted with me and he said, can we use these colours? And I said, well, what? That's you. But red is absolutely important. And the black, of course, and the yellow. And the way he described it, I said, that's brilliant. And that went up, and that was first displayed at a demonstration in Adelaide. It was a political demonstration, and we're ostracised for that as well. But that's the birth of the Aboriginal flag, and Bob was instrumental in that. That's probably something you wouldn't even hear out there. You also had the Chilbrookie Trail, which was mentioned this morning. Now, Bob, when I was the director of the Aboriginal Affairs Department during John Bannon's era in Adelaide, Bob just happened to mention that to me. He said, well, what do you think of this Chilbrookie Trail? I said, tell me about it. And he told me and the records behind it. So I don't know where I got the money from, but we had those rock monuments placed in those very spots down towards Victor Harbour during that time. And the first time that was the Chilbrookie Trail was physically measured and constructed in a way that people can drive up and read a little bit about the ancient history of Aboriginal people of that era as told through that particular legend. Of course, Bob was right at the centre of that. Then you look at NAIDOC, how NAIDOC developed. We in Adelaide were the first. I convinced the Lord Mayor of Adelaide, Wendy Chapman, who was ostracised for the Hindmarsh Island Bridge issues much, much later. But Wendy Chapman was the first Lord Mayor in any capital city in Australia to have a National Aborigines Day Observance Committee meeting and celebration in a town hall with the Aboriginal flag flying, plus cups of tea, biscuits, or whatever it was that needed to be. Is this telling me to shut up? And sorry.
The audience can object.
Now, where was I? Cups of tea. First time that the NAIDOC celebration was brought into a capital city town hall to be celebrated for and on behalf of the Aboriginal people. So that was a great thing. And, of course, who was always in the background? This fellow here. We took the political hard knocks. Bob and I were very close on the artistic side. And on another occasion, while Bob was involved at the Arts Board, I became the vice president of the Second World Black and African Festival of Arts and Culture to be held in Nigeria. That's a mouthful, isn't it? So it is shortened to FESTAC. But that FESTAC was held in 1976, and we had 35 tribal Aboriginal people, plus people like Kath Walker with her poetry, dancers that came over, But significantly, Bob had organised to have a gift given to the Nigerian government of Papunya paintings. And it's been on my mind for years now. In fact, Bob and I have a meal occasionally at my place when he's not tending to his calf. I was intending to talk to Bob and say, why don't we resurrect that exhibition over there, or those art pieces over there, because they would be just those early pieces of art, like Jenny mentioned, would be priceless nowadays. Coupled with that, while I was also the Director of Aboriginal Affairs in South Australia, it just so happened that Ron Bradford, is Ron gone now, had come around with a committee. He was not the Director of the Art Gallery of South Australia at that time. But he came around to me and he said, we would like to accept a gift, and it just so happens from Bob Edwards' Arts Board, as a Papunya art collection, and I don't mean just, you know, 2 feet by 3 feet. I mean the very large original ones that were to be gifted supposedly gifted to the Art Gallery of South Australia. Ron and his committee came around to me as director, as I was at that time. Would it be appropriate that a collection such as this be granted to the Art Gallery and also to be exhibited there for all and sundry to see? You know, I was ecstatic at that, and of course I gave my imprimatur to that, and that collection was given to the National Gallery, the South Australian Gallery, and I think that was one of those times, it's just a landmark issue. When you look at that Papunya art, I think with Bob's involvement with those people out there with, in those early days, as Dick Kimball was saying, with old Derby and so on, because I had a lot of dealings with Derby and the Yuendamu people while being an assistant director in the Aboriginal Affairs Consultations Branch here. I was able to meet and mix with those people, and they sought a lot of advice from me because they knew I'd come from Borroloola and they knew who I was. I'd talk about my tribal name, my skin name and so on, and it'd just be smoothed out and say, well, there's your cousin, there's your brother and so on. And I still have dear friends up there today, so it's even though many of those have gone. So I thought those eras were just absolutely fabulous for Aboriginal people in the context that Bob brought together people of great tribal knowledge, people that had the traditional culture there with them, people like Dick Ruffsey. Dick Ruffsey, when I spoke to him, he knew I was from Borroloola. He came to me and he said, listen here, nephew, because he knew our ceremonies cut across to his area. So he was able to come to me, and I was very close to his brother, Lindsay Ruffsey. And so we had a very strong connection there. But when I get back to old Dick and his involvement with Percy Trezise, I think that is another attempt to get Aboriginal stories in another way across the people with those books with Dick and Percy Trezise. I thought they were great times, and I think Bob was right at the core of that. I know I'm jumping around, but I think he's done so many things. When I look at the art, rock art photographs, and the way the rock art was brought into focus to the Australian community, I was one of those that went out of my way to congratulate Bob on the great work. Sorry, just one more. Just let me close. I think Bob is one of those persons that have been right to the core of where Aboriginal issues were, politically and artistically, and I think he came through on the social issues so strongly that he even converted a lot of the museums in this area, and I think he's done a great deal for us, including my people up north. Thank you very much, Bob.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.